Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. On today's program, George Grow presents this week's science report. Brian Lynn tells us about efforts to protect the tradition of masked dances in Southeast Asia. We end our program with another episode of The Making of a Nation. But first, there is a saying in American English, "Every dog has its day." It means that everyone sees success at some point in their lives. At one American museum, though, every dog has its day, every day. That museum, the American Kennel Club Museum of the Dog, is returning to New York City next month, after operating for 30 years near St. Louis, Missouri. The museum will open on February 8th. Visitors to the museum will find pictures of royal and presidential dogs. They also will find fossils and other evidence of canine history, dating back to 30 million years ago. People can even try to find out which kind of dog they look like most, and train a virtual puppy. Although there will not be real dogs, except for special events, the museum hopes to give visitors an understanding of the history of dogs, how they came to be in such different varieties, said Alan Fausel. He is the museum's director. Inside the museum is a library with around 15,000 books from the American Kennel Club collection. Readers will find pictures and information about different kinds of dogs, from bulldogs to terriers. The museum even has a doghouse specially designed for a chihuahua, as well as movie advertisements of dog stars such as Lassie and Beethoven. The museum's collection also includes a painting of Caesar, a fox terrier beloved by Britain's King Edward VII. America's White House is represented with former President George W. Bush's Scottish Terrier, Barney, and former President George H.W. Bush's English Springer Spaniel, Millie. Next to a picture of Millie in front of the White House is a letter written by then First Lady Barbara Bush. She wrote, "Dogs have enriched our civilization and woven themselves into our hearts and families through the ages, and I am delighted to see them acknowledged." The museum first opened in the Kennel Club's former headquarters in New York in 1982. It moved to St. Louis in 1987 in hopes of appealing to more visitors. But Fausel said the museum only received 10,000 visitors last year. The Kennel Club hopes the new museum, which is close to New York's busy Grand Central Terminal, will see close to 100,000 visitors this year.
Cambodia's centuries-old tradition of masked dance was almost completely lost during the genocidal rule of the Khmer Rouge. But a small number of people have managed to keep the ancient art alive. Now they are passing it down to a new generation. The Khmer Rouge came to power in 1975 after a bloody five-year civil war. During the communist group's rule, it opposed education and religion and banned Cambodia's traditional arts and written language. An estimated 1.7 million Cambodians were killed in the 4 years the Khmer Rouge was in power. The deaths were mostly caused by starvation, overwork, disease, execution, or torture. Among the victims were artists, writers, and dancers. Son Riti's father and grandfather were both performers of the country's traditional dance, which is called Lakhan Khaol. Study of the dance was banned in Cambodia during most of Son Riti's childhood. In the Khmer Rouge, I was young, and they didn't teach people dance. Lakhan Khaol was destroyed, he told the Reuters news agency. Son Riti was finally able to start learning the dance once the Khmer Rouge was removed from power. He was 14 at the time. He is now 48 years old and leads one of the last remaining groups performing the dance. The group includes about 20 performers and students between the ages of 6 and 15. Son Riti says the best way to help the tradition survive is by teaching the dance to new generations. I don't want Lakhan Khaol to go extinct, he said. The traditional dance was recently identified by the United Nations as an art form that should be protected. The UN's Education, Science, and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO, added Lakhan Khaol to its Intangible Cultural Heritage list. Different kinds of the dance are performed in other nations in Southeast Asia as well. The dancers wear colorful painted masks that are made to look similar to characters from an ancient poem. The poem is called Ramayana. It tells the story of a prince who rescues his wife from a demon with help from an army of monkeys. People who study the dance recently rehearsed at a special theater at a Buddhist temple outside Cambodia's capital, Phnom Penh. Phum Pok said his 11-year-old son, Phum Meta, is learning the dance. I want to have my son trained to perform so that in the future we won't lose the ancient art, he said. Cambodia's Minister of Culture and Fine Arts, Phurung Sakhona, said the dance needs to be protected. She urged all people to get involved to help. Elderly performers are trying to preserve the dance, she told Reuters, but it is up to young people whether they agree or not to receive knowledge from the elders. Neighboring Thailand's version of the dance has not suffered the same problems. But dancers there also see the importance of bringing the art to a new generation of performers. In Thailand, the dance tradition is called Khon. It is based on royal history. Many Thai schools and universities now teach the dance. Mom Luang Pongsoa Sukhasvasti followed in his father's footsteps in making Khon masks. He started doing so at age 10. Now he is 67. He still makes dance masks by hand from his home in Thailand's Ayutthaya province, north of Bangkok. Pongsawa said each mask takes about a month to complete. He says he hopes the UNESCO listing will raise awareness of the issue. Teachers now must do more than teaching the dance. They need to help students understand the roots as well, to preserve it, he said. I'm Brian Lin.
After falling for 3 years, carbon emissions in the United States rose in 2018. That information is based on early estimates from an independent research group. The Rhodium Group studies U.S. emissions of carbon dioxide, a gas linked to rising temperatures in Earth's atmosphere. Its new report estimates that the country's carbon emissions increased 3.4% last year. This would be the largest yearly increase since 2010, when the nation was recovering from a financial crisis known as the Great Recession. The research also suggests that the American coal industry continues to struggle because of low-cost, plentiful natural gas. The Rhodium Group reports that coal-fired power stations that produced a total of 11.2 gigawatts of power had closed by last October. Even more were expected to have closed over the following months. If confirmed, that would make 2018 the biggest coal plant closure year on record. Natural gas is now by far the energy of choice in the United States. The report credited gas for an increase of 166 million kilowatts an hour through October. American power consumption and carbon emissions increased in 2018. The transportation industry was largely responsible for the nation's record emissions. Demand for gasoline, the fuel used in most motor vehicles, decreased. But increases in the demand for other fuel, such as diesel and jet fuel, made transportation the industry most responsible for U.S. carbon emissions. The report said another big producer of carbon emissions is the construction industry. Emissions from buildings and homes also were up last year, partly because of very cold winter weather in parts of the country. The Reuters news agency reported last week that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency did not answer its questions about the report. Trump administration officials have said that carbon emissions can change from year to year because of economic conditions. They said the country could both cut emissions and enjoy a strong economy at the same time. Environmentalists say the Trump administration needs to speed up development of renewable energy, manufacturing power from wind and the sun's energy. The country's carbon emissions had been decreasing year by year since 2015, as the nation worked to honor the Paris Agreement on climate change. But even with those reductions, the United States was unable to meet reductions agreed to by the administration of former President Barack Obama. Officials from almost 200 countries gathered at United Nations headquarters in 2016 to sign the climate agreement. Under the deal, the United States promised to cut its carbon emissions by at least 26% from 2005 levels by the year 2025. But in June 2017, President Donald Trump announced his decision to withdraw from the deal. The U.S. will officially withdraw in 2020. I'm George Grow.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. The United States faced a deep national crisis in 1850. That crisis threatened to split the nation in two. It began over the issue of slavery in the new territories of California and New Mexico. Many Northerners wanted to ban slavery in the new territories, but Southern states believed the federal government did not have the right to decide where slavery could or could not go. President Zachary Taylor had no clear policy on the issue. He attempted to be neutral. He hoped the problem would solve itself, but he did not get his wish. In fact, the split between North and South grew wider. Many Southerners said the South should declare its independence from the rest of the country. Then, Senator Henry Clay of Kentucky stepped forward with a plan to save the Union. Clay had left the Senate in 1842, but returned in 1849. He was surprised to find how bitter the North and South had grown toward each other in his 7 years out of the Senate. Clay urged his friends in the border states, those between the northern and southern states, to work to build public support for the Union. He believed their support would help prevent the South from seceding. Clay also began to think about a compromise that might settle the differences between the two sections of the country. He once said, "I go for honorable compromise whenever it can be made. Life itself is but a compromise between death and life. The struggle continues through our whole existence until the great destroyer finally wins. All legislation, all government, all society is formed upon the principle of mutual concession, politeness, and courtesy. Upon these, everything is based." Clay was sure that a compromise between North and South was possible. Near the end of January in 1850, Clay completed work on his plan. Most parts of it already had been proposed as separate bills. Clay put them together in a way that both sides could accept. Clay proposed to the Senate that California join the Union as a slave-free state. He said territorial governments should be formed in other parts of the Western territories, with no immediate decision on whether slavery would be permitted. Clay proposed the western border of Texas be changed to give New Mexico most of the land disputed by them. In exchange, he said, the national government should agree to pay the public debts that Texas had when it became a state. he proposed that no more slaves be sold in the District of Columbia for use outside the federal district. But he also said that slavery should not be ended in the district unless its citizens and those of Maryland approved. Clay said a better law was needed for the return of fugitive slaves to their owners. And he proposed that Congress declare it had no power to interfere with the slave trade between states. Senator Clay believed these 8 steps would satisfy the interests of both the North and the South. Senator Jefferson Davis of Mississippi declared that Clay's compromises did not offer anything of value to the South. He said the Southern states would accept nothing less than extending the Missouri Compromise line west to the Pacific Ocean. Extending the line meant that land to the south would be open to slavery. Clay answered that no power on earth could force him to vote to establish slavery where it did not exist. He said Americans had blamed Britain for forcing African slavery on the colonists. He said he would not have the future citizens of California and New Mexico blaming Henry Clay for slavery there. Clay said he did not want to debate, but wished that the senators would think carefully about his proposals. He said he hoped they would decide on them only after careful study. He asked them to see the proposals as a system of compromise, not as separate bills. Clay expected extremists on both sides to denounce the compromise, but he believed the more reasonable leaders of the North and South would accept it. 1 week after Clay first proposed the compromise, he rose in the Senate to speak in its defense. The Senate hall was crowded. People had come from as far away as Boston and New York to hear Clay speak. Some senators said there had not been such a crowd in the Capitol building since the day Clay said goodbye to the Senate 8 years earlier. Clay had to rest several times as he climbed the steps of the Capitol. He told a friend that he felt very tired and weak. His friend advised Clay to rest and make his speech later. "No," Clay said, "my country is in danger. If I can be the one to save it from that danger, then my health and life are not important." Senator Clay began his speech by talking of the serious crisis that faced the nation. He said that never before had he spoken to a group as troubled and worried as the one he spoke to now. Clay listed his 8 resolutions. Then he said, "No man on earth is more ready than I am to surrender anything which I have proposed and to accept in its place anything that is better. But I ask the honorable senators whether their duty will be done by simply limiting themselves to opposing any one or all of the resolutions I have offered. If my plan of peace and unity is not right, give us your plan. Let us see how all the questions that have arisen out of this unhappy subject of slavery can be better settled more fairly and justly than the plan I have offered. Present me with such a plan, and I will praise it with pleasure and accept it without the slightest feeling of regret." Clay said the major differences separating the country could be settled by facing facts. He said the first great fact was that laws were not necessary to keep slavery out of California and New Mexico. He said the people of California already had approved an anti-slavery state constitution. And he said the nature of land in New Mexico was such that slaves could not be used. Clay said there was justice in the borders he proposed for Texas. It would still be a very large state after losing the area it and New Mexico each claimed. And he said it was right for the United States to pay the debts of Texas because that state no longer could collect taxes on trade as an independent country. Clay said there was equal justice in his resolutions ending the slave trade in the District of Columbia and strengthening laws on the return of runaway slaves. He said the South, perhaps, would be helped more than the North by his proposals, but the North, he said, was richer and had more money and power. To the North, slavery was a matter of feeling. But to the South, Clay said, it was a hard social and economic fact. He said the North could look on in safety while the actions of some of its people were producing flames of bitterness throughout the southern states. Then Clay attacked the South's claim that it had the right to leave the Union. He said the Union of States was permanent, that the men who built the country did not do so only for themselves, but for all future Americans. Clay warned that if the South seceded, there would be war within 60 days. He said the slaves of the South would escape by the thousands to freedom in the North. Their owners would follow them and try to return them to slavery by force. These events, he said, would lead to war between the slaveholding and free states. He said this would not be a war of only 2 or 3 years. History had shown, he said, that such wars lasted many years and often destroyed both sides. Even if the South could secede without war, he said, it still would not get any of the things it demanded. Secession would not open the territories to slavery. It would not continue the slave trade in the District of Columbia. And it would not lead to the return of slaves who escaped to the North. So, said Clay, the South would not help itself by leaving the Union. His 2-day speech gave new hope to many that the Union could be saved. But extremists on both sides opposed his plan.
And that's our program for today. We will be back tomorrow with more stories and information from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson. Thanks for listening.